violin, a pair of oboes, pairs of recorder, and bassoon. That's one of the Dresden Concertos by Vivaldi, Trevor Pinnock, and the English Concert.
Happy holiday season from your friends at WHFR Dearborn here at Henry Ford Community College. And thank you for tuning in to our beautiful classical programming. If you would like to learn more about becoming a sponsor or an underwriter here on WHFR to help bring this programming into the homes and vehicles and offices of listeners just like yourself, we would love to share some details with you. Underwriting is very cost effective. It is tax deductible and it makes you feel good. And best of all, our listeners will truly appreciate your support. Your business, your organization, you can underwrite. If you're interested in details, give me a call, WHFR General Manager Susan McGraw, 313-845-9842. That's 313-845-9842. And we'll talk details of underwriting. Have your business or organization truly help connect our listeners to this beautiful programming.
Good morning. This is WHFR Dearborn, and we're live from Henry Ford Community College, although the college is closed today for the Thanksgiving break, so don't try to come to classes after you're done shopping. No, it's not open. But what is open for business is the new WHFR Journal, local news and views. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, and today is Friday, my watch says the 23rd. Is it the 23rd already? Yes, I guess so. Susan Morrell, our news director, is in the studio with me this morning, and she knows what day it is.
Yes, it is.
No,
it
you
is
don't.
Well,
you do, but you can't be heard, so let's turn up the mic. There you go.
Thursday was, that was yesterday, that was Thanksgiving. Happy belated Thanksgiving.
Well, same to you.
To Jay and all of our listeners. And so today is November 23rd, which is known as Black Friday, but Jay and I know it as No Shopping Day.
Well, it is a Buy Nothing Day, which is even worse than No Shopping, but we will talk about that a little later. I was thinking the other day, why is it Black Friday? That has a very ugly connotation, unfortunately,
yeah.
For African Americans, that black is not supposedly as good as white or what, you know, and it's amazing how racism comes into everything we do, and we've got to try to be conscious of that and reject it. But Black Friday, I guess, even though the connotation of the word black through history has not been the most positive thing, and therefore the Stop Shoppers, including Reverend Billy, who we'll talk about later, that's what they want us to, how they want us to see it. Nonetheless, it is because, I found out, retailers hope to go into the black. If they've been losing money all year, the holiday season, beginning with the day after Thanksgiving, is the time when sales will increase so much it'll cover the debts from the lack of sales for the rest of the year. And so, of course, in Michigan, where business is not great, where employment is extremely high, getting into the black, maybe just in one day, would really be helpful to all of them. And of course, I wish the responsible merchants of our community well in that regard, no matter what we say later in the hour.
Well, absolutely, that's true. But I've been listening to the news. I'm a news addict, and I listen to the news every day. And for the last few days, all I hear from the commercial stations is they just talk about shopping and how everybody's getting up early, going to the malls. I mean, like 2 o'clock in the morning or some crazy thing like that and standing in line at Best Buy.
Yep.
I mean, isn't that a bit much?
Well, we did a public service announcement here mentioning that in 65 countries around the world, including the U.S. and Canada, today and tomorrow internationally is Buy Nothing Day, which is to get people to think about the reasons behind what they buy and the amount of what they buy. Yeah, nobody really wants to go into debt to charge things that they can't pay eventually, even if they believe it's a way of showing their love for someone else, you know, that money shouldn't be the criteria for the expression of love, even though, of course, we know realistically there's a connection there. There has been so much so in our society. Well, that public service announcement did not get very good response from both our staff and a couple of listeners who complained that it was not the right thing to do to tell people to stop shopping.
But that's not really what the ad was doing.
No.
Wasn't telling anybody to do anything. It was merely a suggestion. It was talking about the thought process, mm-hmm. and saying, can you do it for one day? Can you stop shopping for one day? And I think most people can do it for one day, but can they do it today? That's the question. When all the advertising is, they're overwhelmed with advertising, right. and the pressure to buy for Christmas and the sales. I mentioned this to my nephew yesterday at Thanksgiving dinner, that it was Buy Nothing Day and don't spend any money, and he started talking about the sales. So you see, they've got him already. He's only 13. He doesn't comprehend that sales mm-hmm. go on every day.
Yes. Yes, it's true, and we should try to fight that. In most churches, whatever religion, this time of year, they will talk about the true meaning of the season, even if they're not Christian churches, and usually love and forgiveness are high on the list of the true meaning, but, of course, materialism gets in the way, the idea that stuff can replace true meaning or true spirit, true affections. And of course, I think everybody in their consciousness has heard that before, and they sort of agree. Probably 99% of the people would agree, but then they go out and they keep shopping because of the media. That's right, radio, TV, and the way our country is set up, they want us to buy, and most of the time they want us to buy things we don't need.
And I bought two papers. Normally I buy the paper when I'm coming in for the journal. Normally I should read the papers every day, but I usually buy the papers on Wednesday and Thursday to prepare for the show on the new WHFR journal. Mm-hmm. And I bought the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, both of them yesterday. They were so fat, the papers, but they were filled with, the majority of the paper was ads.
Yes.
Sale ads. To buy, to get people out to buy today on Black Friday. So you see, there was very little news and mostly ads.
Very little, yes.
And mm-hmm. this is what everybody sees. They pull out the ads and they look and they shop at the dinner table after Thanksgiving dinner. And what can I buy? What can I buy? And I don't know.
Well, it is a slow news time. There's no doubt about that, even looking in the Dearborn papers, because government is kind of shutting down and you know, legislators are going home, and so there's not the usual flow of events and activities. There's special events and activities for the holidays, but there's not as much hard news, as they say. Although, I see crime is still big, and last night I happened to catch a local television news, and there was a policeman shot someone who probably deserved to be shot, and that was the lead story. So thank goodness. Otherwise, how could we keep the news stations alive?
Well, that's true. And then the big lines at Best Buy in the middle of the night, people getting up at ungodly hours, I think, but and to stand in line at 2 a.m. And the store opens at, what, 5 a.m., something like that? But somebody, of course, came and took cuts, as people invariably do, and then they had to call the police.
Well, yeah, because a riot ensued. I love that word. It shouldn't happen that way, that you know, but it does. And so try to stay calm up there. If you've already been up since 4 a.m., have a nice lunch, relax, and maybe stop shopping for the afternoon. We'll talk about Reverend Billy and the movie that's coming out in the theaters in Detroit probably in the next week or two. It's not hasn't been released yet here. It's in New York right now. It's a great documentary feature on this campaign by Reverend Billy, who's actually a performance artist, a comedian, if you will, but he actually has a mission that is serious, and it ties into, although it's not directly related to, has no direct connection. He didn't cause Buy Nothing Day to be formed. That was the Adbusters Foundation in Vancouver, British Columbia, that started that about more than a dozen years ago. So, okay, I'd like to get actually into some news here. Forget about all the stuff about the season and shopping. The Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday, November 18th, had, unfortunately, they lead with fight that Netzel Ford High School and the Dearborn High School kids got into a fight on a bus, a Dearborn High bus, and the teacher that was with them was struck and bitten, too. Hey. Guys bite? Is that a guy fight?
Is that the new weapon of choice?
I don't know. but the two Etzel Ford High students have been suspended. So anyway, the director of communication for the school district here, Dave Mustonen, former student of mine, hi Dave, said the altercation occurred November 9th when automotive tech students from the schools went to Willow Run Airport in Ypsilanti on a field trip. They went to see the field. Since both classes were going to the same facility, not yet named, it was decided to share a bus. Sounds logical to yours truly. Uh-huh. As the bus was leaving the facility that afternoon, words were exchanged. Oh, no, words were exchanged between a Dearborn High youth and an Etzel Ford student. A Dearborn teacher on the bus went back to talk to the Etzel Ford teen. Mustonen then said the student said some things to the teacher, who then returned to his seat, not wanting to start a confrontation on the bus. Because the bus was so crowded, the Dearborn teacher was the only teacher on the bus, although another one was following behind by car. Mustonen said that although the Etzel Ford youth attacked the Dearborn High teen, it wasn't clear if the latter said something that provoked him. When the fight broke, because they're probably everybody clammed up, you know, as they say. Do you say clamming up anymore? You know, ew. Don't, you know, you don't rat on your friends, even if they're guilty of one kind of mayhem or another, you know. Anyway, when the fight broke out, the teacher tried to get the Dearborn High School student off the Dearborn teen, but another Etzel Ford student struck the teacher, breaking his glasses. An interpreter for the deaf, who was also on the bus, flagged down either a Willow Run Airport police officer or a Michigan State police officer who boarded the bus and helped break up the fight. Oh, my gosh. Once things had calmed down, the teacher realized he'd been bitten by one of the Etzel Ford students. And I bet some CSI did a teeth mark thing, you know, a jaw impression on that. He added that both schools still are looking into what happened and a formal hearing will be held. From initial reports, it looks as if crosstown rivalry may have had something to do with the incident. The fight came up at Monday's Board of Ed meeting, and Board President Pamela Adams commented that some students don't think of themselves as belonging to the same district, but as rivals from different schools. And that's not the holiday spirit, you know. It's not.
Well, we weren't expecting a vampire for Thanksgiving.
That biting, that's that. But I think it was daylight hours, so that couldn't have been. Of course, they were in a bus. So.
Well, speaking of students, Jay, I have an article here in the Detroit News, and it says a student group wants less violence, more guns.
guns where? In the schools?
Well, yeah. The effort calls for concealed weapons on campuses. And this fellow is a student. His name is Mike Guzman. And thousands of other students say the best way to prevent campus bloodshed is more guns.
Not concealed weapons for the students.
Yes, he's an economics major at Texas State University, and he's among 8,000 students nationwide who have joined the nonpartisan Students for Concealed Carry on Campus. Mm-hmm. And their argument is that students and faculty licensed to carry concealed weapons should be allowed to pack heat along with their textbooks.
Yeah, it's a topic. You know, we do have concealed carry in Michigan, although you had to go through licensing process, and I think concealed carry for a number of reasons is still not possible in the city of Detroit, and I can't remember exactly, but it's very, very hard to do, to get that license or that permit in Detroit, and it certainly does not include in Michigan on college campuses or schools. You know, it's pretty much the same regulations for public schools or colleges and universities, public colleges and universities anyway. However, I think my question is, you know, the responsibility and the actual skill ability of people to use the weapons appropriately. Actually, I'm not against concealed carry for adults who've been trained properly and licensed properly, which may be radical to some people that thought I was highly liberal out there. It has not been clearly proven to me, and I've checked on the statistics, that concealed carry states where they allow adults properly licensed do not have any increases in crime, and in fact some of their numbers are actually going down. So I think a properly licensed, properly trained adult should have that option. The school situation, I think probably that K-12 schools, and this seems maybe ridiculous, but I think there has to be those magnetic portals like they have in the airport, and they have to have guards, maybe even guards with weapons, at the doors and on duty in the building, especially in those schools where there have been these kinds of problems with guns, knives, other weapons brought to school. I do believe I'd like to see all society as a weapon-free zone, but that just can't happen. There's too many guns and weapons of a variety of sorts in our society. But let's try to keep the schools focused on education and,
But what about on college campuses?
Well, it's a tough call. Like, I know our security, as many security departments at the college, we have a weapon on campus, and it is accessible to our security office. They don't have concealed carry. Not every officer carries the weapon, but we do have a weapon, and we're licensed for that. But college campuses, I just don't see the need for that, and this person is from Texas somewhere who is leading the effort, and I visit Austin, Texas frequently. I believe that's the site of the tower because I've seen it, that in the 50s there was a sniper up there who was just picking off students right and left, you know, from that vantage point with his high powered rifle. And that was one of the first sort of sniper attacks from a U.S. citizen that we ever had reported. It was scary, to the whole country. I think that was in the 50s, the mid 50s.
But they say it's a basic right of self-defense.
Well, yeah, the question is, I guess, if an adult properly trained and licensed can have concealed carry in that state, then why not those same people on a college campus where most of the people are almost always over 18, if not 21. I don't know what the age for concealed carry is, whether it's 21 or 18 in Texas or Arizona.
But would you feel comfortable on a campus like that? I don't think I would.
I think my lectures would improve greatly. I think they'd have to.
I don't think I'd feel comfortable knowing that possibly somebody sitting next to me has a weapon.
Yeah.
And, if I say something they don't like, they might shoot me. I mean,
well,
I don't know.
You know, the whole idea of the paternalistic society, where society acts as a parent and protects you even from yourself, I think we have to decide as a society what those limits are. Some people think government can protect us from everything, including ourselves, and should. And we'll pay the cost in personal freedom, but I don't think ever any system can protect us from ourselves or from other people. There are many different kinds of people, and if we don't learn how to include them, involve them, deal with them in nonviolent ways, I think that's the issue for our future. That it should not have something to do with our, you know, just merely the right of expression to kill someone or to shoot someone.
I just don't think it's ethical. I think it goes against, you know, the what you say, the tenets of education is supposed to be a learning environment. It's supposed to be a peaceful environment. It's supposed to be an environment where people learn to get along. Yeah.
They can drop their, if you will, defenses and then just focus on learning stuff. You know, it's hard to learn if you're under stress, and you might be under stress if you know the other person's got a gun and that they might use it. Now, again, most people that are rational that have guns, and there's many great gun owners in this country, great, I mean, is that they understand that they wouldn't use it even emotionally. They would use it only for personal self-defense when they had to. You know, those are the responsible gun owners, and I think a majority of them, of the gun owners in this country, vast majority, are of that sort and that mind. However, other people who have easy access to weapons, and just we got so many out there, we can't possibly register and legislate them. Canada tried to license all guns, and it's now cost them over $10 billion, and the computer system they put in practice doesn't work, and it doesn't include that a lot of Canadians just won't license the guns they already had. But of course, the interesting question is, why did Canada even do that? They don't hardly ever kill anybody with guns up there. They've got more guns per person than we have that are owned, and they don't have the murder rate, the crime rate with guns that we had. Nowhere near it.
Just, well, it must be a consciousness issue. That's the only thing I can say.
It's a mindset that government should protect us from ourselves, even if we don't need protecting. And I disagree with that, certainly. But the Canadians have unfortunately discovered that their licensing plan is it's doomed. I mean, really, it hasn't worked, and they've already spent billions on it. As I said, the last count I heard was $10 billion, and they didn't need it at the outset. Although, again, the idea of government helping you to protect you for any future problems that might come up is not necessarily a bad idea if it could ever work. I just think there's too many things that can happen that we must be open to, we must plan ahead for, to resolve conflicts in peaceful ways. And I think we could put our money, like Canada should have put their $10 billion into conflict resolution classes, the history of peace movements and so on in the schools.
Isn't it true that the police don't carry guns in Canada? Is that true, or am I incorrect?
I'm not aware that that is true, which means I think that the police do carry weapons.
They do.
Canada.
Okay, because it's a lot less,
the Mounties, maybe. I don't know.
It's a lot less of a violent society in general than we are here in the United States.
That's it, yeah. The incidence of crime is so low as to almost be non-existent compared to the rates in most urban areas of our country. But they have crime, and they're very concerned about it. But it's just much, much lower rates than ours, especially in regard to the use of weapons in crime or for criminal purposes. And as I said, murder rates are much, much, much lower, as they are in England and France and other places that also have licensing, though, and gun use regulations. Although it's interesting that New Zealand, if not also Australia, where you can only own a gun if you keep it in a locker with a lock on it in a private gun club. In other words, you cannot take it out in public. You can own it, but you can't take it anywhere. You keep it at the gun club, like a country club, whatever. You go there and you shoot at targets, and that's it. That's the only way you can have a gun in New Zealand. However, it hasn't stopped the massive rise of the use of illegal guns for crime throughout New Zealand. So they have heavy-duty licensing, heavy-duty criminal penalties for gun possession. Every gun is licensed, and all the legal ones are in these gun clubs, which means people do not have a gun if they wanted to protect themselves in their business or in their home. And crime with guns is skyrocketing in New Zealand for whatever reason. So
obviously that's not working.
No, gun licensing doesn't work in the way they expect, and in some cases, like even the licensing system in Canada, they just can't make it happen even. And even when it's in place, it's not going to stop it.
I mean, I understand that people want to be free and to protect themselves and all that, but my issue is I just don't see that it's necessary for students and faculty college campus. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I'd feel very comfortable going to a class knowing that the professor might be packing heat or whatever, you know, or a fellow student. And one of the reasons that I don't have a gun is because you have to learn how to use it. I'm not fond of guns. I don't like them. Mm-hmm. You'd have to go to shooting practice or whatever. They're very loud. They make a lot of noise. They cause damage to your hearing.
Well, you're wearing headphones now, so you just keep those on when you start practicing.
But I read an interesting point years ago. I don't know where I read it, but they said just having a gun in your possession attracts somebody else to it.
Yes.
It attracts violence.
Well, if it's
it
not,
attracts
number
violence.
One, if it's not properly stored, and the cautionary tale, folks, if you do have a gun for your own self-protection or whatever personal reasons you have in your home, you should have a gun lock on it. It should be in a lock cabinet. That key or the combination should be very secure because there's so many accidents with children. You
exactly.
see the guns on television and the movies being used, and it seems exciting or heroic, and they just want to play with them. And then they find out, unfortunately, that they were loaded and or accidentally discharged at a friend, a loved one. And so the first thing is if you're going to get it, you must secure it. And that's where most of the problems come in. The second issue is you need to be properly trained. You need to know where the safety catch is. You need to know how to aim it and shoot it. And you need to know the laws in Michigan about when
right.
that's even legal, which, and the laws are kind of based on fairness,
yeah.
in terms of whether or not violent force is necessary. It's not always necessary in every situation.
Well, that's true. And if you happen to pull it out to defend yourself, if you don't know how to use it properly, that person can take the gun away from you,
right.
and then for sure they will kill you, right. I'm sure.
So, I believe in the right to bear arms, which is a national issue right now. It's coming up on Tuesday at the Supreme Court.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Is the Second Amendment an authorization for individuals to own guns themselves? And that basic question is going to be supposedly announced or answered on Tuesday, or maybe they're just pleading the case, but it's at the Supreme Court level now. So
is that for the whole United
yes.
States? Really?
Yes.
Well, isn't
US.
That strange that would come up all of a sudden?
Well, the Second Amendment in the Bill of Rights, Second Amendment to our Constitution, does talk about the right to bear arms. And then it goes on to talk about that a militia is necessary, blah, blah, blah. So some of the people today who don't want individuals to have guns, maybe for their own protection or society's protection, say, no, that Second Amendment only talked about guns for like the state police or the police in that state, in individual communities, not individuals. Well, I think historically they're really crazed, but they want a modern interpretation that would be good for our current society.
Well, who is they?
The people that are in favor of banning all guns from private owners.
Oh, they're the ones who brought this
up? Yeah, the groups. This is not the NRA that wants this ruling. But the groups that want to see all handguns, and for that matter, why not all guns, licensed. And I mean, they would love to see them all destroyed and all confiscated and totally eliminated, and they think that would help. But again, then the only people having weapons will be the criminals, because the criminals are not going to turn in their weapons, and they're going to try to acquire them to get an even further advantage over all the people that don't have them. So it'll be interesting to see where the Supreme Court comes on that, since they're mostly Republican conservative judges. Now, a conservative interpretation of the Constitution, I think, should say that individuals have the right.
Well,
to
I
guns.
Think people should have the right.
But I am totally on the other side in favor of anyone buying a gun, and of course, those buying it legally, and I'm just talking about them, but they need to be licensed, and they need to, and part of that licensing process is to get gun training and information about the laws. Now, it's interesting that in Michigan, you only are required to get the training and the information about the laws if you want to get a concealed carry weapon. But if you just want to buy a weapon, well, you don't have to take the course.
Go to a gun store and just buy a gun?
Yes. Well, you have to be theoretically licensed. You make an application to your local city, and like in Dearborn, you have to go, if you live in Dearborn, you have to go to, after you get the gun, it's not technically legal for you to have it even between the gun store and the police department, but you take it to the police department first thing in a secure case under lock and key, and then at the police department, you fill out a registration. that you have that gun. And they do what's called a safety check, which means does the gun, you know, slide and does the trigger work? I mean, you know, a used gun might be, maybe it doesn't even work well. It might be a danger to everybody. So the cops don't do anything too extensive, I understand. They just do this. It's not called a gun license. It's a safety check proof form or something like that. The wording, it's the same effect. They get your name, your address, and the kind of weapon that you have. But it is required by state law that you file that information of what gun you have, when you bought it, and where you live with your local police department. But no, you don't have to take a course. You don't have to know anything about gun safety or the Michigan laws that you should follow in regard to carrying it, transporting it, and discharging it. So,
but I think a better consciousness for people who are feeling threatened for whatever reason, and you do have to be careful in our society today. Just they say, be aware of your surroundings, be careful who you associate with. Don't hang out with criminals and people who are doing things illegal, and just be careful. And if you do that, you should be all right.
And I'd like to get on. We've got a couple other issues here. And such a great holiday show. We're talking about guns and violence so far.
Well, it just happened to be in the paper.
I know. And this one, too. And these are all things that we should think about and consider maybe new approaches.
But this is not our way of celebrating.
I'm extremely concerned. I'm not in favor of new laws in government to protect us from ourselves when it hasn't been proven that we need that sort of protection. You know, I think we have a lot of useless laws that, number one, are almost impossible to enforce, but secondly, we didn't need in the first place, that there's no evidence that we have to be protected from this or that. Sorry to mention the war on terror or the Iraq war, but there was no reason for that, folks. And once we figured out there was no reason for it, we should have got out of it. And it's sad to say, but on Thanksgiving, we should reflect on the sober issue that we've killed about 120,000 Iraqis for no reason.
Right.
Oh, yeah, when we invaded, there were soldiers that wanted to protect their country from our invasion, from our taking over their country, and they died, you might say, as heroes, protecting their country from their point of view. Yes, there's some insurgents. Yes, there's some terrorist Al-Qaeda groups, but there weren't any there then. They didn't cause 9/11. They didn't cause the Pentagon attack or the United 93. Iraq was not responsible for that, folks, and they're not they were not then a hotbed of shielding terrorists from prosecution, worldwide terrorists. Yes, Afghanistan and now Pakistan, we understand. But since we can't get at them, for whatever reasons, you've heard the story before. I mean, I feel very sorry and very guilty because that whole war and everyone that we killed and all of our own valiant soldiers who were only doing what they were told to go and invade and fight, that really it was all and I know I'll get criticism in vain. You know, it wasn't necessary. We didn't know that then. No, the public didn't know that, but I think our government knew it. And I think they had other reasons that have been suggested by people wiser than me about why we started that. But we must not, you know, do conflict that is not necessary or set up laws in place that are not necessary. And there's too much of that.
But, Jay, I have another story here about college campuses.
Okay.
And this also is in the Detroit News, and perhaps you can shed a lot of light on this. And it says on the title of the article, it says, colleges shift away from tenure for professors on college campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole story about that. And would you like to shed some light on that issue?
Well, I was interested a couple days ago that they had a story about tenure and the rise of the numbers of part-time, also called adjunct faculty. Now most of our college classes, both at Henry Ford Community College and at the four-year schools, 2/3 to 3/4 of the teachers are part-timers, which means they only teach a class or two at greatly reduced pay with, in most cases, no benefits, no health benefits at all.
Right.
And so these are highly educated, intelligent people, but they're not around the college much because they're only part-time. And in order to have a living wage, sometimes they have to teach at several colleges.
Right.
At the same time, and it stretches them. They can't be as good a teacher. These studies in the New York Times on this issue indicates that if you're taught by part-time adjuncts, that the national studies show that you're not learning as well. And they've also traced it into employment rates. You're not as likely to get a job. That's scary. You know, we want to believe here, certainly at Henry Ford Community College, that we hire the best adjuncts, well, that we can find. Unfortunately, we pay one of the lowest rates of any community colleges in Michigan to adjunct teachers. It did get increased, thank you. Our new president raised their pay $1, I think, an hour, at least in the last year, and that was more than they got in the last 12 years. Actually, no increases to speak of at all for them. And so this is almost a class of indentured servants, which used to be called slaves in the olden days. But it is not fair to these people who are highly educated and are trying to direct the future of our country by educating our students, this is in higher ed, to the final bit of in-depth and challenging information and skills before they get into the workforce, before they really can help our society. And to do a second-rate job, which may not be the teacher's fault, but just the situation they're put in, I think it's actionable, and that's, again, a metaphor for criminal. I think even though there's no crime committed, it's just not as good as we can be with education.
Well, let me ask you this, Jay. What about the teachers' unions? Mm-hmm. What are they doing to support tenure for college professors?
Well, tenure, that was the question you started with. Tenure is where the full-time people that are hired have to go through a process you could call a probationary period. And at different schools, there's different criteria before you can become tenured. Once you're tenured, unless you do some terrible crime, some horribly immoral action, and you could be prosecuted for it, you're not going to be fired just because, let's say, you're a bad teacher. And so there is an interesting question there. Well, why do we let that happen then? If a person does get tenure, and it's not easy to get tenure at a four-year school, but when they do get tenure, you have to go maybe 6 years or more of writing papers and impressing your colleagues, and then they vote you into the tenure situation. But after that, you could take it easy. You could turn into a lazy, bad teacher, and they couldn't kick you out. The reason for tenure, though, is to guarantee teachers the maximum amount of freedom in their instruction so that they can challenge students, even bring up controversial issues, and the trends in society can't affect them. So they are protected from the usual pressures so that they can teach what is needed to be taught in as objective a way as possible, and they don't have to, I guess you might say, they don't have to be politically correct necessarily. They have to give the widest range of information, and some of it will challenge students' basic core beliefs, like about shopping, and ask them to reevaluate their lives, their thoughts, and even their skills. So I see the pros and cons of tenure. There have been some teachers who once tenured take advantage of that and then become bad teachers, lazy teachers.
No, but what is the union's position on all of these
teacher unions across the country are in favor of tenure because of the protection of freedom of speech and classroom instruction from the vagaries of our society, the political pressures, the social pressures, the social trends, or even the President of the United States saying this or that about something. So the unions are in favor of tenure. They want to protect the workplace from those pressures so that education can be as full, as complete, and as challenging as possible.
Well, let me say from a student's perspective, and I've taken many, many courses and classes, and I personally believe that there is a necessity for a student to develop a relationship with a teacher. In other words, to be able to ask questions, perhaps after class that you didn't have time during the class. Usually they're so busy during the class giving the lecture, there's not a lot of time for questions or to explain things further. And I find that important, to have access to the teacher. And if you don't have access to the teacher, if they're never there, you can't discuss papers or questions or tests or things you didn't understand. I would have a problem with that.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with adjuncts. They don't have a commitment, and they're not being paid to have office hours.
Or, well, that's how can you get a better understanding of what you're trying to accomplish in the class if you don't have access to the teacher?
Getting back to teacher unions. Teacher unions have been frustrated, but they've been trying for years to pressure and put into contracts criteria whereby the administration has to hire more part-timers, more full-time teachers, because that is the answer to this instructional dilemma. But because of cost issues, and they can't be totally forced to hire full-timers, or at least they refuse to allow that sort of guideline to be put in place, they always have to say, well, we don't have the money and we just can't do it. They have to have the sort of economic out, and so it hasn't happened. So the teacher unions, including our great AFT Local 1650 here at Henry Ford Community College, have struggled valiantly, and the latest effort is to try to, they have raised the issue, and they're trying to support the adjuncts in getting their own union, which would help them to negotiate in solidarity for better pay and better benefits. Maybe even a way that eventually, after 20 years, maybe they could become full-time automatically if they've done, or I don't know. That's a crazy thought. But I do think, since all other efforts to minimize the number of adjuncts have been unsuccessful across the country, probably unions for adjuncts, which will unfortunately also kind of make them officially an adjunct for life, maybe it's still going to be better for them. So we'll see where that goes. It is an educational issue that is of concern to, it should be of concern to everyone in higher ed, including the students. We have great adjuncts here at the college, and they must be greater. Why would they be here taking such little money? You know,
well, they're dedicated.
They're dedicated.
I think if someone really wants to teach, you invest your time and energy. It takes a lot of time to get the degrees, to go through the classes. I mean, you have to be very, very dedicated. You have to be persevere and get the good grades. And then when you come out, you want to teach. I mean, you don't want to go somewhere else and do something else after you've invested your life.
Yeah, well, that's true. Let's do some local stories here. The other headline story that came up, which I don't totally understand either, but it seemed to be very controversial. I caught part of the Board of Ed meeting on cable here in Dearborn. The CSO project, that's a combined sewer overflow project mandated by the government to keep our city and our area able to have clean water and not be overly polluted, especially when the rains hit and we get a lot of rain, and the sewers were overflooding and overflowing and so on in the past. Well, this project, which is between $300 and $400 million, is still ongoing, but it has now impacted on the athletic field at Dearborn High School. And here it is. Monday, the Board of Ed unanimously approved using bonds for $5.5 million to renovate athletic facilities at all three high schools. But a new wrinkle is that plans for the football field at Dearborn High School could be affected by the city's sewer remediation project. The combined sewer overflow project was mandated by the government in 87, and I've explained that to you. The field sits on a floodplain, and other suggestions are to lift the field or build a berm or a dike around it so it won't flood. Judging from the discussion from Monday's board meeting, both sides were working on their individual projects pretty much in the dark of what the other's plans were for the site. Since about last week, school and city officials have been in informal talks about the field, primarily whether it should be a synthetic or natural grass field. Okay, fake grass or real grass? According to Jerry Uchtdorf, the district's director of operations, the city wants to find out if it and the district can work together to everyone's satisfaction. He added that, quote, significant construction, unquote, on both the districts and the city's parts would be taking place in the area, and the city wants the desires of both to coincide. That seems appropriate. Superintendent John Artis advised the board that since the ramifications of flood mitigation go beyond his and Uchtdorf's expertise, he wants legal advice as well as technical help to assist the members in coming to a good decision. So the school district is going to have to hire lawyers and also engineers before they can relate to the city's request. And at the outset, first I had to say, $6 million for athletic fields? Oh, okay. I mean, it's part of the high school experience, I guess. But secondly, is this required because of the combined sewer overflow project that might, you know, dump water onto Dearborn High School football? I don't understand this, and I guess, obviously, the school district doesn't either. And they're not willing, this is finally what I don't understand, they're not willing to take the city's opinion, because the city knows what it's doing. It's been working on this CSO, this combined sewer overflow project since 87, it's almost 20 years now since they knew they had to start it, and we're actively building it now. And so I know that, the city's planners and engineers have this knowledge, but the school district isn't willing, apparently, to accept the city's knowledge about this and how it might impact on these fields. Oh well. Just hire some consultants, I guess. That's the only thing you can do.
Jay, can I do a little follow-up to our interview with Dr. Corsi from last week?
Sure.
We interviewed Dr. Jerome Corsi, who is a Harvard PhD in political science. He wrote the book The Late Great USA, and he was talking about the falling dollar in his philosophy in his book. And here I found an article on the internet called FT.com, that's the website, and it says here, OPEC to study effects of the falling dollar, and this is from Reuters, and it says OPEC said it would study further the effect of the falling U.S. dollar on its economies. Falling calls for it to price oil in currencies other than the greenback. This meeting with OPEC was an attempt to bridge the divide within the group over how to respond to the dollar's decline. Iran and Venezuela had pushed for OPEC to move away from the dollar in the face of strong opposition from the summit's host, Saudi Arabia. And the president of Iran said in the leaders meeting that the falling dollar meant oil producers were subsidizing the U.S. government and the U.S. American people. They get our oil and they give us a worthless piece of paper, he said. We all know that the U.S. dollar has no economic value.
Yeah, there's a long story on that. Candidate for president, Republican presidential nomination, Ron Paul, wants us to go back to the gold standard, the gold and silver standards, because what we have is funny money. We have money that has no connection to reality, to value in the real world. And so if we have like these mortgage crises in the U.S., that's a perception that our economic structure is not solid. I mean, there's all these problems. It's just a perception. But that perception is enough to decline the value of our dollar internationally because our money is not based on anything.
Well, I just don't like the idea of being held hostage by Iran and Venezuela.
Plus, you might say, well, the dollar bill, the coin, whatever, is a promise to pay. The government promises to pay. But we know the government our country is deeply in debt. We have borrowed to pay off the interest on that debt. We can't repay everybody a dollar of value for a dollar bill. We can't. There's no. So the promise to pay thing is not there, folks, because it's impossible.
And who are we in debt to, Jay?
Well, right now, mostly international bankers, and a lot of them are Japanese, Saudi Arabian, and Chinese.
Well, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. It's the people that we. Well, not necessarily the Japanese, but the people in the Middle East and the Chinese that we buy so much from, that we have mortgaged out our country by this kind of spending. Stop shopping.
And that relates to the war in Iraq.
Well, Kind of, yeah.
Right.
Let me just, we have Carrie Zaitz here today, and she is going to, I believe, do her Night Sky Report for us live. And that's going to begin in 12 minus 4 is about 8 minutes. And that's going to be exciting today that as a teacher now in high school, she got the day off because they don't have school today, as neither does Henry Ford Community College, of course, or any other school, I think, for that matter. And so she'll be here in 8 minutes. There's two things about Tim Skupik. Now, Tim Skupik is the fellow that for public broadcasting does his shows does a program once a week that's carried on public broadcasting, a television show, half an hour show called Off the Record, and it sums up the what's happening in Lansing. And yes, things do happen in Lansing. It's our government, our state government, and they sometimes even make laws that are good for us, and sometimes they drag their feet, like for 8 months or more, or a couple of years before they can figure out a budget answer or a way to solve a budget crisis. Two things had been suggested during this time, and both of them, surprisingly, have been reinforced and supported by Tim Skupik. Now, he doesn't often take a position. He just reports on how crazy things are statewide and by our legislature. One that he got into is term limits, term limit reform, that we must eliminate term limits or at least lengthen the terms of people in office so they get some experience on how to be a legislator. Yeah. That would help. Even Gary Warrenchuk coming out after 6 years, he said, I was just starting to learn how to do it.
Yeah, but why is it so complicated?
Well,
why does it take so long?
Tim Skupik, in last Sunday's November 18th here in the Press and Guide, he has mentioned now, unfortunately, that term limit reform has died. There's no hope this year, and maybe the guesses are 2010 or 2011. I think we ought to get a petition going, folks. The legislature is not going to reform themselves because they're just too, well, they're newbies. They're all newbies. They don't know how to do it. They can't.
Yeah, but Jay, I mean, fine. You give them mm-hmm. more, you eliminate term limits, but how many of them are really dedicated to learning what they're supposed to do? I'm not sure that.
Well, that's what we have to elect people for. The other thing is that had been proposed is to have them reduce their pay or to make them part-time, which would also reduce their pay.
Well, maybe there's something wrong with the process if it takes that long for them to learn.
Right.
Maybe it's just too complicated.
Well, it is. We should have a training academy that the legislators could be elected to the academy, but if they don't pass their classes, they won't get to be legislators.
No, but why is it so complicated? Because of all the legislation? Is that the case?
Well,
or?
Okay, and maybe you need to take some civics classes, with all due respect, Susan. It is hard to learn the system and the way to play the system to greatest effect for the good of the public, not just for your own political future. I remember all of the songs that we sang in high school rock or whatever that was called, about how a bill gets passed, you know. But it's the process is rather complicated.
But I think voters are a little impatient with that. That's
well,
why
absolutely.
I'm the voice of the voter, and I was standing by and listened to all the impatience of the voters when they couldn't resolve the budget up in Lansing for the past year, basically.
Skupik seems to be on the right side here, at least, and there's even letters to the editor. I think it's in one of the Times Herald newspapers this week that commend Skupik. Somebody's actually reading him. No, it would have to be the Press and Guide because he's only in the Press and Guide, but they commend Skupik on his positions. And of course, his knowledge is supreme. For 30, 40 years, he's been doing the show. He's been in Lansing. He knows all the players. He knows what happens behind the scenes. And so we should trust his judgment.
I trust his judgment, but I question the process that mm-hmm. it takes
sure.
that long.
Well,
to learn.
Next week, we're going to talk to Frank Bewick about that.
Well, maybe he can enlighten
yes.
us on that one.
Because he also goes back in time a ways, as I do, and Skupik does. And we're looking forward to that sort of extended interview live here on this show next week, Friday. Friday from 10 to 11 o'clock. Remember that the new WHFR Journal, we're moving And in 2 weeks from today, on December 7th, we're going, the day that will live in infamy, we are going to move to a new time on Fridays from 1 to 2 o'clock. Now, the podcast will still be in place if you're listening at after 2 to our website, whfr.fm. We will be there for you after the new show will be available as the podcast after 2 p.m. on Fridays. And that's on December 7th. Next week, 10 to 11, Frank Bewick's going to be here.
Well, I hope you would discuss that issue with him, Jay.
Every issue we can possibly discuss with him, we are going to do that.
Okay.
Let's just have a brief comment about Reverend Billy's movie here before we end the show and feature the Night Sky Report. And Carrie has just come into the studio, and it's always most professional to see if your microphone works. So, no, that's not it. No. Tell us something exciting. Tell us about where you're teaching right now.
That's not it. Okay. Teaching at Grosse Pointe North High mm-hmm. School. Okay. Teaching earth science to ninth graders.
I don't
hear myself, Jay, by the way. Do you hear me?
Yes, but let's turn your microphone.
Oh, okay.
Plug up a little bit.
There I am.
There you go.
Holy mackerel. Turn that down.
Too loud.
Turn it down. Okay.
Is that good?
Too much meat, yes.
Okay.
That's great. Thanks.
There you go. And is it colder at Grosse Pointe North than it is Grosse Pointe South? Or
different weather patterns completely, okay. Yeah.
Does Santa Claus come?
That stupid jet stream. It's just all over the map.
Okay. Well, at least we know your microphone works, and thank you for coming by today.
I'll be quiet now.
Mm-hmm. And what's your topic today going to be?
Selling the moon.
Ooh. No,
mining the moon, actually. Not
yeah,
selling the moon,
yeah. Well, almost the same. Speaking of selling, I'll do this bit, and then we'll turn it over to Carrie. And got to cue something up here, folks. This is radio. And coming up at 11 today, big band music with our new DJ.
LaBeth.
LaBeth. Okay. I had to get it right. See, it's LaBeth is here, and she's all set with her music. It's going to be very exciting. Just a little movie review here from the New York Times. What would Jesus buy? Mm-hmm. It opens. It has already opened in New York, Los Angeles, and I expect to see it. Now, I've already seen this film, folks, at a film fest last year, and it is fantastic. It is very entertaining. It is by a filmmaker by the name of Rob Van Alkemade. It's a fast and funny documentary. Again, the title is What Would Jesus Buy? It's the answer to the question posed by the title, that whatever gadget of the moment that their spoiled, rotten kids are craving. In other words, what would Jesus buy? Well, almost anything people buy these days. According to the film's subject, Reverend Billy, the charismatic bleach-blonde performance artist and mock evangelist, whose real name is Bill Talon, this is part of a larger problem. His get-up may be for show, but his activism is the real deal, and his mission is to fight what he calls the shop apocalypse, the buying frenzy Americans indulge in every holiday season. The film takes us on a 2005 cross-country tour with Reverend Billy, Savitri D., his wife and organizer of his church of Stop Shopping, and the church's gospel choir. Along the way, they deliver their message that peace and love, not spending, are the true backbone of holiday spirit. Through witty speeches and songs to unsuspecting patrons at assorted problem spots like Walmart, the Mall of America, and Disneyland. Reverend Billy is zany and energetic enough to hold the attention of those he's preaching to, average to extreme shoppers, many clueless as to what globalization means, long enough for them to consider his crusade. At the very least, the film might make a viewer think twice about the next purchase at The Gap. So try to catch that. It should be in the Detroit movie theaters or somewhere in Detroit movie theaters, maybe the Main or the Maple in a week or two. Well, we have to say goodbye for today's new WHFR Journal. Thank you for tuning in and listening. And we're going to rise from these mundane matters to celestial things with Carrie Zaitz and her Night Sky Report. And then coming up after that is Big Band Music with LaBeth. So take it away, Carrie.
Thanks, Jay. Today's is a tongue twister. So.
Just a moment, though. Good. A moment of silence before Carrie starts talking.
Okay. I was 5 years old when Apollo 17 astronauts Gene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt took their last steps on the surface of the moon. They paused to place a plaque that read, "Here man completed his first explorations of the moon, December 1972. We never imagined that it would be the final exploration of the moon, but 35 years later, we seem completely earthbound. The 12 brave astronauts who traversed the dust of the lunar Maria have no successors as of yet. Noise is beginning to be made, however, of a new race to the moon. In the late 60s, the main concern for space travel was political. The Soviet Union had launched the first satellite into space, that famous beeping sphere called Sputnik, and had also beaten us into orbit. The only way to save face in the world domination game was to land men safely on the moon, which we did 6 times. The threat eventually passed, the Cold War ended, and the motivation to go to the moon lay sleeping for decades. New motivation has risen and has shifted to economics. So what's on the moon that anyone would want? We know the dusty surface is pulverized regolith, mostly a basalt powder blasted out of craters from the moon's pummeled surface. We have lots of basalt here on Earth from volcanoes. But the moon harbors a mineral called ilmenite, which is an iron titanium oxide. It's not important for its own chemical makeup, but for its ability to retain helium-3, a product of the solar wind. The sun streams high-energy particles in all directions. Earth's magnetic field deflects most of this material, but the moon has no such deflector. The particles slam into the moon and are trapped in ilmenite. It is said that 220 pounds of the lunar rock could yield $140 million worth of helium-3. At $40,000 per ounce, helium-3 would be 26 times more expensive than platinum. But what is it? Helium-3 is a lighter form of regular helium, the stuff that makes balloons float. Helium-3 is valuable because it could provide a cheaper, safer, and more efficient way to produce energy. Nuclear power plants currently use nuclear fission to break apart heavy atoms like uranium to get energy, but they leave behind toxic nuclear waste. Fusing atoms creates much less waste and is more efficient. Unfortunately, there is very little helium-3 on Earth to fuse. When President Bush announced his decision to send us back to the moon by 2018, a committee was formed to research the feasibility of such a project. Sitting on the committee were none other than Neil Armstrong and Harrison Schmitt, the Apollo 17 astronaut, one of the biggest proponents of mining the moon for helium-3. The committee built a small reactor to test theories of the helium-3 fusion, and it produced energy. However, it will most likely take decades to produce and test commercial reactors. Meanwhile, we aren't the only country interested in the moon's supply of helium-3. China, Russia,